This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the 50s and 60s, one of the few paths to home ownership for Chicago black community and black communities all over the country was a home sales contract. Now, these are shady deals that are marketed as mortgages, but were in fact rent-to-buy agreements, and they were structured in a way that cost buyers their entire investment if they missed or were late with just one payment. Black families were particularly vulnerable since they were virtually cut off from conventional mortgage loans because of redlining. The Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University explores the impact of these contracts in a study and in part of a new documentary series. Researchers found these predatory housing contracts stripped black families in Chicago of up to $4 billion in wealth. Bruce Ornstein is artist-in-residence with the Cook Center. He's also co-director of the study and creator of the documentary series. The episode that explores the home sale contract is entitled The Color Tax, Origins of the Modern-Day Racial Wealth Gap. Bruce, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Really glad to be here, Frank.
Tell us more about these contracts, kind of how they were structured.
Well, you have to look at what a mortgage is to then understand a contract. And with a mortgage, you give a down payment on a house. You then make monthly payments. And in time, you build equity in your property and you begin to build wealth. And during the 1950s and 60s, that's where we got America's middle class. Average person was building wealth through equity in their homes, buying homes and slowly building up that kind of savings. Well, it's different for black families. And unable, as you pointed out, because of redlining, to be able to get a loan from a bank, they in turn were able to only get money through contracts. And they would not get any equity in the property, and they would make a down payment, oftentimes in excess of what they would have made if they had been white. And they also paid double the cost of the home. So they were in a kind of like a locked in this closed market. And if they wanted to own a home or they wanted to live in a home and they wanted to escape the conditions of what in Chicago is called the Black Belt, the ghetto in Chicago, this was a way to do it. So imagine making a payment of, a couple hundred dollars a month at the time. That's what monthly payments were. Doing it for 10 years and then deciding you wanted to move. You had no equity in the property.
And by the way, these were marketed. There was some shady marketing going on. So there was a deliberate effort to mislead the buyers into believing that they were building equity in many, many cases, most cases.
Yeah, in a number of cases, people thought they had mortgages.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a mortgage. Right. And they had no protections that other people, the basically white Chicago, had with a bank and a mortgage. And, so they were easily evicted. And there was incentive by the seller, the contract seller, the predator, the housing predator, to evict people because they evict someone, keep everything that they put down on the property, and then they do it all over again
with another buyer. And you're talking about, as you talked about, moving out of the neighborhood. So there are these suburban developments now that are being shown to primarily black families because segregation is still a very important part of life in the North as well. We have to understand that at this time, segregation was, if not legal, certainly the fact in the North. But this is a way out, a lawn, a fence, and your own place. And so these are the developments that are being sold, right?
Yeah. So, to what extent that was being done, we measured that in this report and found that, the great, great majority, about 85% of the black population looking to buy homes during the 50s and 60s had to buy them on contract. And it cost, a tremendous amount of wealth accumulation and possibilities for black people.
We're going to talk more about that in detail and also the documentary that documents much of what we're talking about, and I want to hear a clip from that now, the documentary episode entitled The Color Tax, about one family's experience with a home sales contract.
Like many Americans, Sally and Albert Bolton aspired to a home in the suburbs or a better neighborhood inside the city. But in the 1950s, those options weren't open to black families. So they made a down payment on a house in what was called Chicago's Black Belt. For 2 years, they met their monthly mortgage payments on time. Then one day, they received an eviction notice for being late. One time, on one payment.
That was when they went to see my father.
Mark Satter was an attorney who lived in the racially changing neighborhood, North Lawndale.
What they asked of him was just to slow down the eviction. They said, you know, we only missed one payment. Like, we think we could pull this together. And if you could give us some time, you know, we could keep it.
Reviewing the Boltons' papers, Satter was surprised to see that they had paid three times what the seller had paid for it. In fact, he explained to the Boltons, this isn't a mortgage, it's a rent-to-own installment contract. And the man who drew it up, Jay Garan, he's the real owner.
After hearing this, they said we were misled in too many ways, and we want to sue him, and we want to stop this.
Historian Burl Satter speaking about her father, attorney Mark Satter, an excerpt from a documentary episode entitled The Color Tax, produced by the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. I'm joined by the series creator, Bruce Orenstein. The documentary screens Saturday at 2 o'clock at the International Civil Rights Center Museum and Museum in Greensboro. We have to come back a little bit. So we talked about redlining briefly. Remember, this is the federal government now, in a deliberate effort to build wealth and build a middle class, decides to guarantee mortgage loans to do just what you said. Let's build wealth among working class Americans and build a middle class. But we're going to prohibit these loans. We're going to prohibit these loan guarantees from certain neighborhoods, black neighborhoods. That's federal policy.
That's
so
right.
That's number one. Now that's why I can't get a normal, conventional loan. Now I'm getting cheated. But because I don't have full participation in the legal process the way other immigrant families might have had, right, mm-hmm. from other immigrant populations, Italians and Irish, all now represented in the Chicago City Council and the Chicago Judiciary. No such representation for black families when they're cheated. So all of these things make them exceptionally vulnerable to this kind of contract.
It's the whole system seems to be aligned against black families.
Talk about the number and the amount of money that the amount of wealth that gets lost. We're talking about building a middle class. Here's a whole sector of our population that can't participate. How much?
Well, we estimated there were 85% of the population, like I said, black population, who were buying homes in Chicago during those days, were left with no other option but to buy through contract. And, there were some people who were able to get mortgages. And there was a handful of black banks that were giving out mortgages and black insurance companies who provided mortgages. But if you wanted to move into mostly this affected the banks in Chicago. Actually, there was a study that was done that documented 263 banks in Chicago or savings and loans, most of them during those days. And out of those 263, only one gave loans to black families moving into white neighborhoods. So, that's the way the market was so close. So what we did is we dug into researchers from the University of Illinois, from Duke, from Roosevelt, from Loyola, dug into the land deeds, into the Recorder of Deeds office, and were able to start to calculate per house how much people lost. So, as I mentioned earlier, black families were paying twice as much for the property. Oftentimes, they would be getting evicted, lose all the money that they put into it. But if they even paid it off over that period of time, they would have paid more than $70,000 for their home had they been white. And then, calculating the number of people that paid that $71,000 more for their property, we came up with $3.2 billion to $4 billion plundered, as Ta-Nehisi Coates refers to it in the documentary, plundered from the pockets of black families.
Right. And this doesn't even include the amount of money that this is if they had been able to own the house and then resell it. But so many lost the property and then didn't have that rock or that equity to even pass on to their children as other families
yeah,
would have.
Exactly. I've got a personal experience with this in many ways. My parents grew up in Lawndale, and they were fortunate enough to be able to move to Skokie, one of the suburbs. My father drove a taxi. And my father's income was quite low and quite middle class, though, during its day.
Right.
And he had the same kind of income as one of the people that we interviewed in the documentary who bought on contract. They both bought their house for $27,000. They both paid off their house throughout the years. The gentleman in Lawndale, the community, he even made more money than my father. But my parents ended up with a several hundred thousand dollar investment when they paid off their house. And the gentleman in Lawndale, the black family, had much, much less. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the difference between being able to then send your children to college, to so many other things. And that explains, in large measure, the wealth gap that we have, the racialized wealth gap that we have between black and white families.
Well, I want to bring another guest into the conversation, again with personal experience. Clinton Boyd Jr. is a postdoctoral associate at the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center at Duke. He is also from North Lawndale, and that's one of the communities in Chicago where the home contract sales were going on. Clinton, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, talk about your personal experience growing up in that neighborhood and what you knew about all this just as somebody who grew up there.
Yeah, definitely. For myself, growing up in a North Lawndale community, much of the information that was conveyed by way of the documentary was unknown to me as a child. Primarily because I feel as if this was a hidden history in many rights. And I think that's one of the beauties of the documentary, because it's really unearthing a phenomenon that needs to have a spotlight shined on it so we can begin to think deeply about the type of solutions that we need to bring to bear to deal with what in many rights was a wealth drain that took place between those two decades within the 1950s and 60s. And just thinking about my own personal experience in relation to the subject matter, when I think about the lack of wealth that families collectively were able to accumulate and amass within the North Lawndale community, it really speaks to a lot of the social consequences associated with not being in a position to benefit from the type of wealth that contributes to the public education system in a community. So when myself being a proud product of the Chicago public school system, I have to admit that I'm somewhat of an outlier in that I'm a newly minted doctor. I'm a postdoctoral associate at the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center at Duke University. But the harsh reality is that 70% of the black men in my age range in the North Lawndale community today are ex-offenders.
Say it again. 70%.
70% of the black males in the North Lawndale community today, in a contemporary sense, have a previous involvement with the criminal justice system, to the point where it has been estimated by a small group of researchers that because of the stigma that is typically associated with having a criminal record, roughly $50 million were these men have a loss annual earning of roughly $50 million.
Each. Yeah.
Collectively right. Among those men who come from that community.
Over that time. So, and that's just in one community. And, of course, Bruce Orenstein, this was not, you looked at Chicago. Ta-Nehisi Coates, of course, a few years ago in the Atlantic, really began to open our eyes to this. And now you're drilling down and seeing the absolute consequences over time. But it wasn't just Chicago, right?
No. Detroit, Milwaukee, Cleveland, Baltimore, you know, all the major urban centers in the North. And it happened in the South, too. I can't imagine, you know, we don't have any statistics on what happened, let's say, in Durham or Raleigh. We haven't looked at that. And, you know, that's data that, you know, needs to be gathered. But I imagine that contracts were also sold down here as well.
Yeah.
So it's happening across the country.
What is it? What you made it out, Clinton? You talked about the fact that now you're, you know, postdoctoral candidate. You've got your PhD. You're at Duke University. What are the consequences, though, in that neighborhood? You talked about again the fact that 70% of the men there are criminal justice involved. What do we do going forward? What do we do about this?
Well, I think if Dr. Darity was sitting here with us.
Sandy Darity, who's the head of the center.
Right. I think he'll definitely use the statistics that have been brought to bear to describe the wealth drain that took place specifically in the city of Chicago as added ammunition to have a much-needed conversation around having race-based policies specifically in around reparations to narrow the or frankly eliminate the racial wealth divide that is prominent within American society. And as Bruce alluded to, while this report was specific to the city of Chicago, Chicago in this context is merely a microcosm of what likely has taken place in a lot of cities in the North, in the West, and in the South during this particular time period. And if we can estimate that roughly $3 to $4 billion were plundered from black families within 2 decades in one city, just imagine what that number will look like if we had more comprehensive, more robust data at the national level. And so I think, again, this is a conversation that is worth having because we first have to get the information out there and make it available to the general public. And from now, we can collectively come to the table and think about what types of solutions we need to consider in order to eliminate the racial wealth divide within our country.
And Bruce, the $4 billion that we're talking about, again, over only 2 decades in just one city, is just the amount that was actually extracted from the people who thought they were going to be homeowners in over the course of those contracts. So it doesn't look at the multiplier effect. What if you had that wealth to take out a second mortgage to send your son or daughter to college? And because you didn't have that, you didn't. So what about the education they didn't get because you couldn't invest that money? I mean, the multiplier effect, what you've lost in subsequent generations is staggering.
It's incredible. You know, there's a 20-to-1 racial wealth gap between what white families have and what black families have in their wealth. We're not talking about income. Right. We're talking about wealth. And wealth drives so much, right? It allows you to send your child to college. You draw off of... You know, we're going to have a conference in a little while about black entrepreneurship. 25% of small business owners draw off of their mortgage and their home equity loans in order to start up their small businesses. So it has a tremendous effect. And when we think about redlining, when I first asked my students, and I talked about this years ago with the students in a class that I was doing about segregation, you know, they know a little bit about redlining, what that is, but they have no idea what this backstory is. Actually, most people don't know about this whole backstory to contracts. And so it was not only that money did not come into the community because of redlining, banks did not invest in the community, but on top of that, the contract sellers were pulling, plundering out of the pockets of, you know, billions of dollars out of the pockets of black homeowners.
And, you know, you think about, too, again, you know, you often hear this argument about from people who say, well, white immigrants came into this country, they were discriminated against, and somehow they overcame it. Well, those Italian and white neighborhoods were able to turn over, and they were able, those Italian and Irish families moved into other neighborhoods. When you have a proscription like redlining, there's one group of people who are stuck there by federal policy. They don't get out, and that stigmatizes the neighborhood forever.
That's right. And there's a pre-story to this, too. There's a lot of history to this, and how we ended up with redlining, you know, happened in the 20s and the 30s. So
federal policy. I mean, that had a lot to do with it.
Driven by the real estate industry.
Driven by the real estate industry. Yeah. So very briefly, Clinton, yes, please.
Oh, yeah, and I just wanted to kind of respond to the comment about having European immigrants specifically come into the country and have an opportunity to basically take full advantage of many of the opportunity structures that existed in America. I think it's also very important to put it in its proper context. It's one thing to come to a country voluntarily, and it's another thing to come to be a descendant of a racial group that was brought to the country involuntarily. And that has ripple effects.
Not to mention the amount of wealth lost there, but we don't have time for that, sadly. Clinton Boyd, Jr., postdoctoral associate with the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center at Duke University. Bruce Ornstein, co-director at the Cook Center and the creator of The Shame of Chicago, which is an episode on predatory housing contracts. That one called The Color Tax. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Hey, thank you. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you.